Hello everyone, my name is Katie Sandlis. I'm with the Georgia Department of Public Health, and today I'm going to be speaking with you about Georgia's Ebola active monitoring system for travelers returning from Ebola affected countries. So first, although I know we're probably all familiar, I'm going to share some background about the 2014-2015 Ebola outbreak. It was the largest in history with over 28,000 cases and over 11,000 deaths. It originally began in Guinea, but ultimately affected 10 countries. Ebola came quickly to Georgia when patients were transported from Africa to Emory for care. Everything changed in October 2014 when a patient who had traveled from Liberia was diagnosed domestically in Texas and ultimately infected nurses caring for him. CDC responded with enhanced surveillance procedures, which included airport screening and active monitoring of travelers returning from Ebola-affected countries. These travelers underwent risk assessments upon their arrival at customs in the U.S. They were asked about any potential exposures and had a temperature and symptom checked. If they were sick, they then had a medical evaluation. Travel information was collected and sent to public health in the receiving state via EpiX. Once the receiving public health jurisdiction got travel information from CDC, they were then able to initiate the active monitoring process. And what this looked like was travelers returning from affected countries were required to do temperature and symptom checks 2 times a day and report those daily to public health for 21 days. In turn, public health was required to monitor these daily checks and rapidly identify any travelers exhibiting symptoms and, as necessary, isolate, evaluate, and treat them. Georgia was told that we were expecting to have an upwards of 130 travelers to monitor on any given day, and given 1 week to implement monitoring procedures, we had a lot to do in a short amount of time. So the first thing we did was we panicked a little bit. We needed to rapidly increase our 24/7 capacity, but we had very little staff to be able to do so. Thankfully, however, we have some really smart folks on our EPI team and our IT team who were able to work together to create our Ebola Active Monitoring System, or EAMS as we call it. It's a web-based module housed within our state electronic notifiable disease surveillance system, or SENS. It was up and running in less than a week, and it met our needs of allowing us to monitor travelers with limited human resources, rapidly identify ill travelers, and share information among our stakeholders. So before I progress any further, here's a summary of what the information sharing process looked like from start to finish. First, CDC sent the Georgia Department of Public Health a line list of travelers, which we then entered into EAMS. DPH then called and enrolled those travelers to enroll them in active monitoring. The traveler then reported their temperatures into EAMS daily using the online tool. DPH monitored those travelers for symptoms and to make sure that they were reporting daily. And we reported the outcomes to our leadership and to CDC. So now I'm just going to walk you through what EAMS looked like and how it functioned through the use of some screenshots. This is what our traveler record in EAMS looked like. An epidemiologist would create this record after we received traveler information from CDC. I don't know how well you can see it on the screen, but we have the traveler-based information there. We have name, date of birth, as well as some Ebola follow-up information, so if the traveler had any language needs, if they had a clinical event, any of us who needed to follow up with that traveler at any given time, even if we didn't have previous information, would have the information to be able to do so. And then scrolling down in the traveler record, we had detailed information on that person's travel history and their risk assessment. We also had fields for the traveler's email address and a space to create their unique username and password. We could send this information to them via email, and then they'd be able to log in to report their daily temperature checks directly into EAMS. When they logged in, this is the screen that they saw. So they'd report what day they were reporting for and the time. They'd enter their temperature, and then if they were experiencing any symptoms, they could select the picture for the Ebola-related symptom that they were experiencing. If they did report a fever or a temperature, we were notified immediately by email, and then we would know to follow up. We did, of course, also inform the travelers that if they did experience symptoms at any time, they were told to call our public health hotline immediately as well. Now, when our epidemiologist logged into EAMS, this was a screen that we saw, our traveler monitoring dashboard. It allowed us to have basically situational awareness of all the travelers at any given time that we were monitoring. So the pale gray square there that's covering up everyone's names, if you look directly to the right, you can't read it, but that's the status of the traveler. So the system automatically sorts travelers by the urgency of how soon we need to address them. So right at the top are symptomatic travelers. So travelers who, when they most recently reported their symptom checks, they either reported a fever or an Ebola-related symptom. We know we need to call those travelers and determine next steps. Below those are individuals who have not reported symptoms within the last 24 hours or haven't reported a check within the last 24 hours. We know we need to call them and get them to report to us right away. Below those are individuals that we have not contacted yet. They need to begin their monitoring period, and so we need to call them to get them enrolled. To the right, you see all these yellow squares. This is basically just a pictorial representation of each individual's monitoring period. All the yellow squares are their 21 days of monitoring. Each white circle represents a temperature check that they've reported. If the circle is red, it means that they reported a symptom or a fever. The blank ones means that they missed that temperature report. Also, the orange squares indicate that that person is traveling outside of Georgia during that time. So we know that we need to notify the receiving jurisdiction they're traveling to about their travel. So one great feature that we were able to add during the process of monitoring was our employee active monitoring system. Nearly half of all the persons that we monitored in Georgia were CDC employees. And at the beginning, CDC employees who were Georgia residents were required to report their temperature checks to us at DPH as well as to CDC. Double reporting was burdensome and no one was happy with it. So we launched the CDC Integrated Monitoring Program back in January 2015. The CDC monitoring team was given an EAMS login, and CDC enrolled travelers in EAMS and then followed up with their own non-compliant and symptomatic employees. CDC employees reported online using the EAMS online reporting tool. And then we at DPH had access to all CDC employee monitoring data and was updated on traveler status in real time. So it was a real success of a change we were able to make in the system while it was up and running. As I mentioned before, we were alerted when we had a symptomatic traveler, whether by phone or via email. We would then triage the traveler to determine if their symptoms were compatible with Ebola-like symptoms or if they had a fever higher than 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit and no clear differential diagnosis. This could be especially tricky because Ebola symptoms are so easily confused with flu and other viral diseases like malaria, can have similar clinical presentations to Ebola, and is also endemic in West Africa. So ultimately, DPH was tasked with deciding whether to send a traveler for a medical evaluation at an evaluation hospital, and if necessary, to test them for Ebola based on the medical evaluation. So this is just a summary of the people that we monitored from October 2014 to November 2015, just over 2,100 travelers. Of those, 32 were some-risk travelers and 16 were high-risk healthcare workers, which we quarantined. For the rest of my presentation, I'm going to be focusing on the low-risk travelers. We had a total of 189 travelers who reported symptoms, 43 required medical evaluations, and of those, 8 were tested for Ebola, all were negative. So this is a graph that shows the number of individuals under active monitoring in Georgia by country of origin from October 2014 to October 2015. Each bar represents 1 week. And as you can see, we had some weeks that were significant spikes in the number of people we were monitoring. From what we can tell, these mostly correspond with holidays. So we had increases right around Christmas 2014. We also had some increases right around the beginning of the school year 2015 as people were coming back to have their kids start school again. And this is a map showing where our travelers were located. As you can see, they were clustered right around the Atlanta metro area for the most part. And as for our low-risk travelers, overall, about half were male, half were female. The majority were between the ages of 25 and 55. Just under half were CDC employees at 47%. About a quarter of the persons we monitored were citizens of an Ebola-affected country. Only 5% of those persons we monitored utilized our translator services. And most chose to report using the online reporting method at 59% versus reporting by phone or email or by text message. We were interested in finding out which of these traveler characteristics were associated with noncompliance. And we define noncompliance as people who failed to report their temperature for a 24-hour period or longer. So we did a multivariate analysis and determined that young travelers were less likely to be compliant than older travelers. Non-CDC affiliated travelers were less likely to be compliant than CDC employees. Both nationality and requiring translation services had no significant effect on traveler compliance. And travelers reporting by phone were less likely to be compliant than travelers reporting online or by email or texting. Now, we were a little surprised at some of the results. As epidemiologists who were speaking with these folks every day, we felt that language barrier was a huge issue, but that clearly, at least according to the analysis, wasn't. And we were also very pleased to find out that apparently online reporting was a huge factor in increasing compliance. So, you know, that's what our data told us in terms of what factors drive compliance, but we can also tell you anecdotally that having traveler buy-in also lends itself to traveler compliance. We found that epidemiologists have the opportunity for trust building during their first interaction with the traveler. The first step really is to listen to the traveler, to assess and use the appropriate level of language. Even though many of the travelers did speak and understand English, there was still an issue with being able to understand one another, just sort of knowing different Americanized phrases that we would use. So just making sure that everyone was understanding each other was the first step. And then also listening to their concerns and fears. Some travelers were fearful about the disease or regarding their lack of understanding of the role of public health. After that, we would then try to educate them about the actual risks of contracting the disease, also about why we were calling them with these questions and what we were going to do with the information. Then we would emphasize our role in trying to protect them. We wanted to make sure that them and their family were going to stay healthy. So then once that buy-in was established, we could then proceed to ask them, you know, how can we help you follow the requirements of reporting? What do you need in order to be able to do that? And we really found that by following this strategy, we were able to encourage our travelers to report with some regularity. Some of the challenges that we faced were some travelers had a lack of access to technology or familiarity with the technology. The travelers who had to report by phone, either because they didn't have access to the internet or weren't comfortable with reporting on the internet, there were some issues with human error in relaying that information from our phone reporting service into EAMS, and that caused some lag in reporting. There were also some cultural and language barriers and just sort of understanding what was the role of public health and what was the purpose of what we were doing. We experienced tremendous success with this system overall. EAMS enabled 2 DPH staff to monitor over 100 travelers at a given time. We had easy access to real-time data and notification of ill travelers, and we were able to easily share the information with CDC and other stakeholders. As I mentioned, EAMS was also adaptable to new users, and it, for the most part, encouraged the vast majority of our travelers to report on time. As far as lessons learned, we've learned time and again that IT infrastructure is critical. The fact that we were able to work with our in-house team to develop this surveillance platform and to be able to mold it over time to adapt to our needs was so crucial to our success. Our analysis showed that online reporting can maximize traveler compliance, and also the importance of gaining traveler buy-in during that initial enrollment call. So that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions at this time.
Great, thanks so much. So please come up to the mic to ask questions.
Hi, I'm Jennifer from Florida again. This really excites me because I'm not sure if everybody's aware, but in Florida we did face-to-face monitoring for even our low-risk contacts. So, all the 2,000 people, they all got seen twice a day in person, face-to-face. So it was a lot of resources and time went into it in Florida. So this really excites me, especially with your high levels of compliance. I was wondering if you had what kind of guidelines you had internally for if somebody was not compliant, how long did you were required to follow up with them to ensure, you know, what the issue was? Did you have to go out in person eventually? What kind of guidelines did you have for that?
Sure. So, when someone was non-compliant, we did everything in our power to get in contact with that person. Call, email, text, everything. Obviously there were a number of times where we needed to call up the health district in which that person lived, and they did make a home visit. But the number of times in which that actually had to happen was pretty rare. Again, I think it comes back to listening to the traveler and gaining that trust. There are a number of our travelers who were, sort of chronically non-compliant. When we really got on the phone and talked to them, we found out that, they worked graveyard shift jobs. And so for them to call in every day before 12 noon was just really not compatible with their schedule. And so we made note of that and made an exception for them to have them call in at a different time. Or, they were having a personal crisis within their family. So it certainly did happen that there were some people who were just really didn't want to comply, and we did have to send them out. But it was a lot of just, personal sort of, touchy-feely
Oh, yeah, I understand. Had lots of face-to-face, heart-to-hearts with people I was monitoring. And you had mentioned, using it for other factors. I was just thinking of other applications. We do long-term follow-up. I'm thinking especially in Florida for all of our arboviral diseases. We actually do up to an 18-month follow-up with our chikungunya patients, and we do a 72-hour follow-up with all of our Zika patients until they're no longer symptomatic. So I was just wondering if, this system sounds like it could be very adaptable for things like that if, our Zika patients could log in. And I was wondering if you guys were using this system for any other follow-up that you do.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It sounds like it could be applicable for that. Currently, right now, it's sitting as it is, being unused. But I'm sure that, the idea is in the future, if there's a need for it, we would like to be able to adapt it for future needs.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
There's someone else with a question. I saw two people get up earlier.
I have a question. Wonderful presentation. I liked the idea that the online tool had a higher compliance than what we're used to in shoe leather epidemiology of face-to-face or phone calls. But one concern I had, and maybe you can squash my concerns, the fact that they could pull down other dates other than today's date and report temperatures. How compliant were they if you just looked at compliance with the timely reporting of their temperatures, or do you think there was any filling in the data with fictitious normal temperatures going back to the days that they may have missed or been late in reporting?
So that's a good question. Technically that question could apply to any of the methods of reporting. Our system is great for a number of things, but it has shortcomings in a number of areas. One of the areas that has shortcomings, I would say, is in being able to go back and gather data and analyze it, because we didn't anticipate some of our data analysis needs at the time when we were building the system. So as far as looking at compliance, we actually don't have the ability to we don't have like a timestamp for when they reported. So we are only looking at, whether we have a report on a given day or not. Now, that being said, there were plenty of times when there were people who were reporting by phone or by email would report several days later with 3 or 4 temperatures. So, it's a proxy. Yeah. But I do want to say, though, we have several ideas about why the online system might have been, might have fostered that greater level of compliance. And we do think it might have something to do with the fact that, this was very personal information that these folks were being asked to report every day about themselves and about their families. And if you were able to report that not to a real person, that's... Right, exactly. Instead of having to call someone up and give all your information to a real person, instead of just giving it into a system, perhaps that has something to do with it.
And so, any other questions? I have one follow-up. Did you do any, especially with the CDC employees that you kind of have a kindred access to, did you do any follow-up or feedback on the experience or whether or not there may have been any falsification or, ask them the questions of how accurate were you treating the temperatures or did people pad them when they were just a little high so that they didn't get harassed by the state?
We didn't formally do any of that. Obviously these are all self-reported. For obviously CDC employees are going to be more knowledgeable of where the cutoff is. For non-CDC employees, they could be fearful about what happens to them if they do get sick. So, it's definitely fair to assume that
they're compliant for their own benefit.
Sure, yeah.
Good. Well, thank you so much.